on my way to work. Garrett Foster was pushing his fiancée's wheelchair and was legally carrying an AK-47 rifle at the protest when Foster shot him four times with his .357 Magnum pistol, later telling police Foster did not point his rifle at him, but, quote, "I didn't want to give him a chance to aim at me," he said. Garrett Foster, the murder victim, and his fiancée, Whitney Mitchell, had been together since they were 17 years old. Foster became one of Mitchell's primary caretakers when she went into septic shock at the age of 19 and lost all four of her limbs. Mitchell's mother, Patricia Kirvin, called Foster her daughter's fifth limb. This is Whitney Mitchell responding to Governor Abbott's request for a pardon of Daniel Perry after his guilty verdict came down. Speaking to KXAN News.
I was disgusted, and I was, it was shocking to see that after everything that me and Garrett's family have been through to get to this point, I was still relieved to see justice for Garrett, and then just for all of that to just be completely taken away is like extremely horrifying, and I don't understand it.
Several people were filming on the night of the protest, July 25th, 2020. This is video of the shooting that was taken by Robert Garrett and then by our next guest, Hiram Gilberto. Warning to our viewers and listeners, this footage includes gun violence. The footage was compiled by KXAN. In his murder trial, Daniel Perry used the state's Stand Your Ground law of self-defense to defend his actions. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles said Monday it's now launching an investigation into Governor Abbott's request for an expedited pardon. A court docket had mistakenly listed Perry's sentencing hearing as being scheduled for 9:15 a.m. today, but the sentencing has actually not even been set. There has just been the murder verdict. For more, we're joined in Austin by two people. Hiram Gilberto Garcia is an independent journalist who live-streamed that night and was the first witness on the stand to testify for Daniel Perry's murder trial. Also with us, Rick Cofer, former assistant district attorney for Travis County, which includes Austin, now a criminal defense attorney. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Hiram, let's begin with you. The horror of what took place. Why don't you lay out what you testified in this trial and your response to the verdict being a murder verdict, but the governor saying he will pardon Mr. Perry? Hiram, I don't know if you heard me, but I was just asking you to respond to the governor saying he's going to pardon Perry, who's just been convicted of murder, and to describe what you said on the witness stand, what you saw that day in 2020 as you were filming.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. July 25th was a particularly difficult day. Just like I had done the last previous 50 days, I was live streaming and documenting the protests in 2020. Explicitly, my role there was to be a journalist and a documentarian. That night, the crowd was making their way up a very populated and important street in Austin called Congress Avenue. There was quite a few protesters, marchers, who were peacefully chanting and marching. Beyond just isolated incidents of small vandalism, the crowd was peaceful. As the crowd was approaching 4th Street in Congress, specifically when I observed the most dense part of the crowd crossing the intersection, I noticed that a vehicle drove into what seemed to be the crowd at what I believe was a high rate of speed. I heard the honk, you know, I heard a thump. I thought somebody had been unfortunately ran over in that instance, and I tried to run to render aid. But as soon as I made my way towards where I thought the incident had occurred, I heard gunshots and ran the other direction. It was an absolutely devastating scene. I was sure I was witnessing a mass shooting at that moment.
And then what did you see, Hiram?
And shortly after that, you know, I noticed that someone that was marching and protesting had been shot. Protesters were emotionally distressed, and, you know, I noticed that a lot of folks were in shock, screaming, yelling, and just really shortly after, I found out that Garrett Foster had been the one who had been shot. And according to the, you know, folks that were witnessing, they told me that he took significant gunfire and that it wasn't looking very promising. Just in that moment, you know, folks were feeling very pessimistic about what was happening.
What was it like to be the first witness in the trial?
It was certainly extremely difficult, you know, going up on that stand as a witness. I wanted to make sure that it was clear that as a journalist, I was only giving factual information about my observations, you know, but obviously that was very difficult to do in a very emotional situation. I think that, you know, ultimately I was able to achieve my goal and relay exactly what I observed. But absolutely, you know, the emotion in that courtroom was high. The attorney that was the defense attorney that was, you know, cross-examining me certainly was very emotional as well. And many, many folks that were live tweeting called a portion of my interview just really highly emotional and a little bit heated. So that really added to the intensity of that moment.
Did you know Doug Garrett?
I did come to become familiar with Garrett.
Garrett Foster, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. Garrett was somebody that was out protesting and marching on a daily basis. We're talking about by July 25th, it had been 50 continuous days of Garrett showing up with his spouse, Whitney, protesting. And so during that time, I was able to interview them quite a few times for my live stream and for my documentation. And in that time, I became familiar with how Garrett and Foster, you know, worked together and why they were down there.
And your response to the governor of Texas, Governor Abbott, following an outcry from Fox, particularly the pushing of Tucker Carlson, calling for the pardoning of the person who's been convicted of murder.
Absolutely. I mean, I find it completely devastating to learn that our governor is willing to circumvent what's already a really important procedure for a justice system in place. The jury sat down for 2 weeks, you know, almost on a daily basis, learning cases, facts of the case every single day. I was present at that shooting, and even I was still learning completely new and unknown facts of this case. And it's hard for me to imagine, as somebody that didn't sit a single day in that trial, that Greg Abbott has full knowledge or understanding of why that jury came to that decision, which is why I feel strongly that this is a mistake by Governor Abbott. You know, this case took 2 weeks of deliberations. I can't imagine anyone who sat there or didn't sit there those 2 weeks could have a fair, you know, analysis of what happened.
Rick Cofer, you're the former assistant district attorney for Travis County, now a defense attorney. If you can talk about the significance of the governor's weighing in right after the murder conviction, before the sentencing, and what this means.
This is unprecedented in Texas legal history, which is what makes it so shocking. I was initially surprised by the verdict in the Perry case. Widely, it was considered a strong self-defense claim and a case that the district attorney was likely to lose. But trials can go any number of different directions, and the jury found Daniel Perry guilty. That's one thing. Last year, the governor pardoned seven people. The year before that, two. You are more likely to be struck by lightning or to win the Texas lottery than to receive a pardon from the governor, let alone a recommendation for a pardon in the middle of trial court proceedings. Daniel Perry has been found guilty by a jury, but he has not yet been sentenced. Technically, under even the Board of Parole and Pardons procedures, he's not even eligible today to apply for a pardon because he hasn't been sentenced. So wildly unexpected and wildly inconsistent with Texas law.
So you told the Austin American-Statesman it's what happens in Uganda or El Salvador, total abrogation of rule of law. And what's even worse is that Abbott knows better. Explain.
At the core of the rule of law is the concept that the law applies equally to everyone. Daniel Perry was convicted by a jury that swore an oath to fairly and impartially follow the law, which heard 2 weeks of evidence and testimony, which deliberated for 16 hours, which was instructed by the judge to only find a verdict of guilty if they believed beyond a reasonable doubt that Daniel Perry did not act in self-defense. Daniel Perry has every right to seek judicial scrutiny of the verdict. He can appeal to the state courts, the federal courts. He can file writs. But he is not entitled to a pardon at this time as a matter of equity. The governor can recommend what he wants, but here's the upshot. Daniel Perry was treated the same as any person charged with murder. Governor Greg Abbott didn't see a single minute of testimony. He hasn't reviewed a single piece of evidence that was admitted into the record. Instead, Greg Abbott's opinion is what has driven his decision to announce a pardon. The rule of law means that jury verdicts, while not final, should be treated as final until reviewed by higher courts. What happens in nations like El Salvador and Uganda, and I chose those nations specifically, I do charitable work in Uganda, I'm familiar with the court system, is when judges and juries make rulings that the powerful interests don't like, the government ignores the courts. The government substitutes its own opinion of what should happen for that of a jury or that of a court. That's exactly what happened here in Texas. Governor Abbott, it appears based principally on media reports from Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, decided that this jury had gotten it wrong, and the governor decided that his opinion counted more than the jurors. That's not how the rule of law works. That's not how due process works. It's a scary precedent for what is to come.
You've noted Garrett Foster was killed protesting the killing of George Floyd, and that in 2022, the Texas Board of Pardons unanimously recommended that Floyd be pardoned for a drug charge in which a crooked cop planted drugs. And yet you now have this situation where, explain.
And I should be clear, the officer involved in the arrest and felony conviction of George Floyd almost 20 years ago has admitted to lying in the search warrant affidavit for Floyd. It's disputed whether or not drugs were planted. That officer is currently pending charges for murder, unrelatedly, in Harris County. But here's the upshot. Garrett Foster was killed by Daniel Perry while protesting the killing of George Floyd. About 6 months ago, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles unanimously recommended that Governor Abbott pardon George Floyd for about a 20-year-old drug conviction out of Houston. The politics of that look bad for Greg Abbott in conservative circles, and he used his power and influence to have that recommendation withdrawn on procedural grounds. Now, without an ounce or a scintilla of appellate review, without a sentence even having been issued, Governor Abbott has made a decision that Daniel Perry deserves a pardon, while George Floyd's pardon languishes in purgatory. It's the type of story that if you were to read it in a novel, you wouldn't believe. And yet here we are. And in Texas, truth is stranger than fiction. And apparently politics counts more than law.
Finally, Hiram Gilberto Garcia, does this make you afraid to continue to film? I mean, you have a car that moved into protesters, and of course, it'll hit journalists or anyone else in its way. It could. And then you have the shooting, a murder conviction. And then, well, it's not clear. The governor says he's going to move expeditiously on a pardon, but we will see what happens.
I wouldn't say fear would ever keep me from going and documenting and doing my job. Although, you know, I do take safety precautions every time I film any public demonstration in Texas or anywhere in the nation. It's really common to see guns, high-powered rifles, and individuals with really heightened emotions. So every time I'm out, you know, I'm wearing a full bulletproof vest, you know, and just hoping for the best, ultimately, training, doing my best for de-escalation. But ultimately, you know, this is a reminder to me of the importance of having a document, a video or a visual of how these movements unfold and why people make the decisions they make. Because as we've seen, you know, without the video evidence, we really wouldn't be aware of situations like what happened with George Floyd and many, many, many other really important historic, you know, events that have shaped this nation. So I'm going to keep doing my job, but with a bulletproof vest.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And Rick Cofer, to your point of you might expect this in countries like Uganda and El Salvador, maybe there they're saying we're only following the model of the United States.
We have to be the leader in the rule of law and democratic values. We have to lead by example. We have to show that elections are determinative and not the threat of force. And we have to show that our judicial system is fair and that it treats all people equally. The proposed pardon of Daniel Perry cuts at and abrogates the very essence of the rule of law. And sadly, your listeners and viewers should expect that this pardon will eventually be granted. Politics has trumped justice in this instance, and theater has trumped the law.
Rick Cofer, we want to thank you for being with us, former assistant district attorney for Travis County, and Hiram Gilberto Garcia, independent journalist, first witness in the murder trial. That does it for this segment. Coming up, Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into a leak of highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents about U.S. spying on its adversaries and its allies. We'll speak with investigative journalist James Bamford. Stay with us. By the Windows, Ukrainian folk song and lullaby performed by Harriet Fraser. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into a recent leak of highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents about the war in Ukraine, as well as Russian and U.S. spying on not only the U.S. spying on its adversaries, but spying on its allies like Israel, like South Korea, like Ukraine. Over the past month or more, the leaked documents have been appearing online on the chat service Discord and on the messaging app Telegram. Many appear to be photographs of slides prepared for a briefing. It appears the Pentagon wasn't aware of the leak until last week. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby spoke Monday.
We don't know who's responsible for this, and we don't know if they have more that they intend to post. So we're watching this and monitoring it as best we can. But the truth and the honest answer to your question is we don't know. And is that a matter of concern to us? You're darn right it is.
While the documents appear to be real, U.S. officials say some have been doctored. Concerning the war in Ukraine, the leaked documents suggest Ukraine has little chance of militarily defeating Russia. One document from February predicted that Ukraine's, quote, ability to provide medium-range air defense to protect the front lines will be completely reduced by May 23rd. The leaked documents also predicted the fighting between Ukraine and Russia in the Donbas region, quote, is likely heading toward a stalemate. Another document indicates members of Ukraine's security services were responsible for sabotaging a Russian plane inside Belarus in late February. The documents also appear to indicate U.S. intelligence agencies had deeply penetrated the Russian military, giving the Biden administration internal information about Russian war plans in Ukraine, as well as operational plans for the private mercenary group Wagner in Africa. The Washington Post reports one leaked document reveals the Wagner Group sought to purchase arms from Turkey, a NATO ally. Documents also show that Egypt, a close U.S. ally, secretly planned to produce 40,000 rockets for Russia. The leak of the documents has also revealed how the United States spied on its own allies. One leaked Pentagon memo alleges that the Mossad, Israel's spy agency, had encouraged Israelis to take part in the massive protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to gut the Israeli judiciary. Many of the documents are based on information gathered by some of the most secret wings of the U.S. intelligence community, including National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the Pentagon's DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Agency, the NSA. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by James Bamford, longtime investigative journalist and author focused on the intelligence community. In 1982, he published The Puzzle Palace, the first book exposing the inner workings of the NSA, the National Security Agency. His latest book, just out, is called Spy Fail: Foreign Spies, Moles, Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. Jim, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us again. Why don't start off by, as you evaluate what has been released, this intelligence, if it's real, and it, by all accounts, it looks real, of the U.S. spying on adversaries and allies, talk about what's most significant and where these documents are from.
Well, in terms of significance, I think the most significant outcome of this is danger that we may lose actual human beings in Russia. Because a lot of the documents indicate that we have collected information from the inner workings of the Russian government, the intelligence services and the military. So there are people that may be giving us information. And now that these documents have come out, it gives the Russians an opportunity to do a mole hunt, to hunt for people who are giving that information away. As a matter of fact, officials told the New York Times and the Washington Post that the revelations might lead Russian mole hunters to the doorsteps of American spies in their ranks. And that's the problem. The problem is that when these type of documents leak, especially during a period of war, there's dire consequences that can happen to the people who are helping the U.S. by giving them information.
And again, talk about these agencies that people may not be aware of. You are the expert on the NSA, many times larger than the CIA, the National Security Agency. But then you have the National Reconnaissance Office. You have the Defense Intelligence Agency. So who is getting a hold of these? And also talk about the platforms that they're being released on. Discord is what, for gamers? And then talk about Telegraph.
Well, in terms of the agencies, there's a potpourri of documents that give extremely detailed information about all these agencies. The NSA, for example, eavesdropped around the world. The documents that were picked up are the documents that were released dealing with Mossad in Israel. That came from eavesdropping, from NSA eavesdropping on the communications of Mossad. So then you have the National Reconnaissance Office. They're in charge of putting spy satellites in orbit, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which analyzes the imagery. Again, that information also came out in these documents because there's documents that show how we were able to collect information by satellite. So there's a wealth of what they call sources and methods, both human and technical, that were released by the documents. Now, strangely, mostly documents that are leaked appear in major news organizations, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, whatever. They never appear on gaming platforms, so this is a first for that. It's hard to say why any of this stuff is appearing or why it's appearing on those platforms. Usually there's three reasons for spying. That was one of the reasons I wrote Spyfail, because there are so many spies out there that the U.S. never ends up catching. And there's three main reasons. One is money, obviously. Most spies want to sell secrets for money. Another is ideological. They want to help a foreign government. They don't care much about money. And the third reason is basically the thrill, or else anger. So that could be the reason that these documents were released. The third reason, anger. Somebody was angry and they decided that they're just going to put these documents on whatever platform they happen to be using. So it's very hard to know. The key point is that the government keeps losing documents. A few years ago, just a few years ago, the NSA lost upwards of half a billion documents. Employees just walking out the door with these documents. They lost three-quarters of cyber weapons, the United States cyber weapons. The NSA lost three-quarters of them. Somebody stole them and put them up on auction. The North Koreans ended up getting the cyber weapons, and so did the Russians, and they turned them on the United States. So there is a complete lack of accountability when it comes to classified information, top secret documents, and so forth. Just walks out the door and nobody ever gets fired.
Well, James Bamford, we're going to continue this discussion with part two after this show ends, and we're going to post it at democracynow.org to talk about the most significant revelations in this, from the war in Ukraine to what's happening in Israel to Egypt to possibly secretly wanting to produce rockets for Russia, a U.S. ally, Egypt, as is Israel. James Bamford, longtime investigative journalist and author, his most recent book is titled Spyfail, Foreign Spies, Moles, Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. By the way, a happy belated birthday to David Prude. Stay tuned to part two at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to Looking at Lyme on CJSF's Speak Up, and I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. Looking at Lyme is a podcast all about Lyme disease. My own journey back to health motivated me to understand the complexities of the illness, testing, diagnosis, and treatment. In each episode, you'll hear from experts in the field of medicine, science, and outdoor education. Together, we learn about topics such as neuroplasticity, pain management, co-infections, outdoor safety, and tick surveillance. You can find out more by visiting our website, lookingatlyme.ca, or following us on Twitter or Instagram. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to hear new episodes.